there's danger everywhere. But danger had never looked quite like this before.
Can you keep a secret?
Based on shocking true events.
This girl, Rena Virk, she's been missing for 3 days.
Emmy Award nominee Riley Keough.
Young girls were the ones we were supposed to protect.
Academy Award nominee Lily Gladstone.
Can't be.
Not be protected from.
A Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays only on Hulu.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
What's up, this your boy Lil Duval, and check out my podcast, Conversations with Unc, on the Black Effect Podcast Network. Each and every Tuesday, Conversations with Unc podcast feature casual and in-depth talk about ebbs and flows of life and the pursuit of happiness. Unlike my work on stage, I tap into a more serious and sensitive side to give life advice and simply offer words of encouragement, yet remind folks to never forget to laugh. Every Tuesday, listen to Conversations with Unc, hosted by Lil Duval on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by AT&T. Connecting changes everything.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
The postcard shows the Twin Towers on fire, rendered artistically in black and white. Haunting, monochromatic carnage compressed onto 4x6 cardstock. The view is from Brooklyn. You can tell because the South Tower burns to the left. Smoke rises up to a jagged line mimicking the edge of a burnt piece of paper. At the top, in calligraphy, it says, "Everyone who knew me before 9/11 believes I'm dead." From iHeartRadio, this is Missing on 9/11, the story of one woman who vanished on the eve of history and my quest to find her. I'm your host, John Walczak. In November 2004, a man named Frank Warren created an art project called Post Secret. The idea was simple and brilliant. Write a secret on a postcard, mail it to him anonymously, and if it was good, he would post it on his blog. It quickly blew up, landing Frank speaking gigs and book deals, and permeating pop culture too, appearing, most notably, in the music video for the hit 2005 song, Dirty Little Secret, by the All-American Rejects. Post Secret had something for everyone. Writers got catharsis, a chance to share deep, dark, personal truths. Readers got voyeurism, plus an opportunity to see who shared their secrets. And Frank got thousands of postcards, including the 9/11 postcard. By now, it's one of his most famous. He even incorporated it into a TED Talk. It's a remarkable, mind-boggling, singular secret. The idea that someone, quote, died on 9/11. But hey, guess what? They're alive? I mean, it's bonkers. Of course, I wanted to learn more about the postcard. When was it mailed? Where was it mailed from? Could Sneha have sent it? And by the way, I'll put it on Twitter at John Walczak, J-O-N-W-A-L-C-Z-A-K. In June 2006, Sneha's disappearance got a burst of attention when New York Magazine ran an article on it. That article, by Mark Fass, is the reason why it didn't just fade away, why it lives on today. For the first time, people seriously considered the idea that Sneha used 9/11 to run away, to voluntarily disappear, to essentially fake her own death. So I wanted to know, did Frank get the mysterious postcard before or after the article ran? If before, I'd be more inclined to think it's legit. If after, though, especially right after, I'd be more inclined to think it's a hoax, a fake bullshit secret sent in by a publicity-hungry crank. Unfortunately, Frank wouldn't tell me when he got the postcard, so I bypassed him. www.archive.org, copies of his old site. And then there it was, the postcard, first published on March 4th, 2005, 15 months before the New York article. Now, obviously, that doesn't prove it's legit. But for argument's sake, let's say that it is. Someone thought to have died on 9/11 actually survived and never came forward, except through this anonymous postcard. Well, who sent it? The list of possible candidates is extremely short because there's irrefutable proof that most 9/11 victims died. DNA, eyewitnesses, phone calls, etc. With Sneha, though, there's nothing. No evidence. So, yes, she is at the top of my list of who could have sent it, if it's legit. Let me say also that although Frank wouldn't tell me when he got the postcard, he did send me a high-resolution image of it. And not gonna lie, the first thing I did was throw it into Photoshop to see if I could make out anything, like a postmark, through the image on the front. Alas, no luck. But it was worth a shot. Finally, I asked an art expert to look at the postcard. He told me that whoever drew the towers likely used either a graphite pencil or soft charcoal. That stuck with me. Remember, in the mid-90s, Sneha left med school for a year and spent 6 or 7 months painting in Italy. Many people who knew her, including Dr. E, one of her supervisors at Cabrini Medical Center, said she wanted to be an artist, not a doctor.
I can't describe her paintings in detail. I vaguely remember. I just remember she was always sketching, and I remember commenting at times that they were beautiful. And she would write. She liked writing. And so I saw some of her writings. She like kind of showed them to me when she was helping me write something. So,
when you say sketching, do you remember, was it pencil, charcoal?
Pencil or charcoal? I don't remember colors.
The first time I spoke to Dr. E by phone, I asked if she knew about the postcard, if she had ever seen it. She said no. So I emailed it to her.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really creepy, right?
That's very bizarre for whoever said that. Whoever sent that.
Dr. E has long believed that Sneha used 9/11 as cover to escape, to start a new life. The Sneha she knew, both professionally and personally, was unhappy. She wanted to escape.
Is it just your gut feeling, or do you have anything to indicate that that might have been the case?
No, so just a gut feeling, but just knowing her, I'm like, oh, there's no way. Like, she's out there. I really believe she's alive. That's just my strong, strong gut feeling. I just knew her personality too well. I don't see her. I just don't see her running to building number one. Sorry. I don't see her doing that. And number two, she was so, like, kind of manipulative and bright and, you know, she could play people, you know?
Mark Bogatin, the attorney hired by Sneha's husband, Ron, after 9/11, doesn't buy it.
Could be that she ran away for whatever reason and was living in Europe, you know, drinking espresso at some cafe somewhere in either large, medium-sized, or small European city. That's one possibility. But in order for that to be feasible, she'd have to have some means of support. There'd have to have been some type of evidence of preparation, bank withdrawals, credit card expenditures, anything like that. And they went through all the credit card records, financial records, bank records. They went through, you know, whatever computer history she had and things like that. And there was no evidence of any type of preparation, any means of financial preparation for any type of fugitive secretive existence. And also there were just some basic things, like when Ron got to the apartment, her travel papers were there, her passport was in the apartment. And I believe even things like her eyeglasses were in the apartment.
So people that say that she just decided, she saw what happened and decided to up and flee and take advantage of the moment, that's...
No, that's crazy. How many people did that? Did anybody do that? Oh my God, look at this. The train center, I'm going to Paris and nobody will find me now. I'm not taking my glasses or my passport. No, that's crazy. It's just ludicrous.
He's not wrong. It is ludicrous. At least the idea. Retired NYPD Detective Richard Stark, who investigated the case, also thinks it's crazy.
How does somebody just get a new passport, new ID, that quick, and just disappear? Unless you planned it. But I don't see that either.
Would that be so hard, though, if I'm having personal problems? And you know, this is 20 years ago, so when technology was more in its infancy, too. What convinces you that it would be so difficult to disappear? Because so many people, so many thousands and tens of thousands of people do it every year. What makes you doubt that in particular?
Because of the closeness to her mother. Her father, she couldn't do that to her family. Not Ron, maybe? I don't know. But her mother and father, no way. They were a very close family. Just like the photos I saw. And she talked to her mother every day.
This is the key piece of evidence most people cite to write off the idea that Sneha used 9/11 as cover to voluntarily disappear. She loved her mom. She wouldn't do that to her family. I get it. But every year, all over the globe, people run off. It's an age-old story. Fathers abandon children, husbands their wives, children their parents. No one wants to think someone they love could just run away. But thousands do, every year. Like Detective Stark, you might say, well, what about her passport, her credit card, her glasses? Wouldn't she need papers? Wouldn't she need help? I'll concede that, yes, it would be nearly impossible for someone to spontaneously run off and escape detection without some help. But remember, Sneha stayed somewhere on the night of September 10th. She stayed with someone, and that person never came forward. So can I see that person helping Sneha escape? Yes, I can. Say Sneha woke up on 9/11, turned on a TV, and saw the attacks. Maybe she decided to stay put wherever she slept the night of the 10th, and then later decided not to go home. Or say she was walking home, saw the attacks, turned away, and melted back into the city. Then what? Multiple studies have examined the behavior of people who voluntarily and spontaneously disappeared and were later found. In a paper titled Living Absence, The Strange Geographies of Missing People, one woman said,
I felt free when I left. As soon as I walked out the door, I felt free.
Researchers found that women were more likely than men to plan an absence, but planning usually occupied only a small window of time. Many people who chose to disappear did so without any idea of how long they would actually be gone. They just decided to leave, then figured out what to do. Most began by walking in urban environments. One woman told researchers,
My mind was going 19 to a dozen. I couldn't sit still. I had to keep moving because my mind was in such disarray. The pacing was to try to keep up with the anxiety I was feeling inside. I just desperately needed to keep on the move all the time. And then, when I started walking along in the streets, I was walking really quite quickly. Initially, the decision to move was just a physical need to move. The pacing up and down and the stomach churning was getting so intense, it was painful. So the only thing that seemed to relieve it was walking fast.
Researchers learned that people who voluntarily vanished went to great lengths to keep their location secret. They changed their physical appearance and clothes. They wore dark clothing and/or clothing to conceal their face. They used fake names. And their immediate journeys were non-linear, characterized by circles, loops, or squares. Lost in chaotic thought, when considering whether or not to return home to family and friends, they were racked with guilt, uncertainty, and fear. Fear of how they would be received as that person who did that to their family voluntarily. A second study characterized the absence of people who voluntarily disappeared as, quote, accidentally deliberate or enacted as an unplanned crisis. A third study listed common factors which led adults to voluntarily disappear, including historic and current traumatic experiences, strong emotions related to being unable to cope, feeling trapped and powerless to talk about or share their feelings, and stress and depression. Initially, when they escaped, they felt elation, but soon that jubilant feeling was replaced by, quote, crisis mobility. They tried hard to avoid detection, to buy space and time to think, to decide whether or not to go home.
I knew I had to stay away from authority, and I had to stay away from people I knew because they were already looking for me.
For weeks, I just traveled about, and after every couple of days, I'd get myself some fresh clothes, go and get cleaned up and washed, and dump my other stuff. I didn't want to be seen. I didn't want to be found.
That's the hardest thing, coming home again. Going away is easy.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets. If you don't win your first bet, that's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Shortly after 9/11, there was at least one possible sighting of Sneha. On September 27, 2001, a reverend named Charles Bakken spoke with a woman he thought was Sneha at a doctor's office in Manhasset, Long Island. He told the NYPD that the woman strongly resembled Sneha, but he wasn't sure it was her. The woman had a strong Indian accent, he said, but Sneha did not have an accent. Neither the NYPD nor her family think the woman Bakken spotted was actually Sneha. Unfortunately, I can't interview Bakken. He died in 2010. On January 24, 2004, the NYPD got an alert that ongoing activity associated with Sneha was connected to an address in Los Angeles. By this point, Detective Stark was no longer on the case, so a different investigator picked it up. He asked the LAPD to send officers to the address. Was Sneha alive? Did she live there? Well, she didn't live there, but Ron did. It appears the alert was a false alarm, some kind of database error. Ron spoke with two LAPD cops, then called the NYPD. In July 2003, he said, he moved back to California, his home state, to restart his life, to pick up the pieces after 9/11. The new NYPD investigator asked Ron again about the mysterious phone call placed at 4:05 a.m. on 9/11 from his apartment landline to his cell phone. Ron, quote, thought about it for a while and came to the conclusion he was so distraught over his wife that he woke up still half asleep and called his cell phone to check the messages to see if she called. The investigator told Ron, quote, there's no physical evidence that supports the theory that his wife died in the World Trade Center incident. There are no witnesses to her being there. Obviously, Ron knew that, but still, he assumed it's probably how Sneha died, at the Trade Center on 9/11. When I started investigating this case, one of the first things I did was search for signs of Sneha on social media and in public databases. A long shot, I know. So I was surprised when Sneha did show up in databases after 2001, linked to addresses in California, including the home where Ron lived, the address the LAPD visited. I also found a LinkedIn profile connected to one of Sneha's email addresses. Strange, for multiple reasons. LinkedIn wasn't even founded until 2003, 2 years after 9/11. The profile has no activity and no friends. It's listed in the United Arab Emirates, or UAE. I reached out to that Sneha, but she never responded. Complicating things and providing a probable answer, there's a different Sneha Ann, without an E, Philip, in the UAE. The likeliest answer, then, to explain why Sneha shows up post-9/11, connected to addresses in California, and to a LinkedIn profile in the UAE, is simple. Database errors. Earlier this year, during COVID, I sat down outside, freezing, at a Brooklyn cafe with an expert on pseudocide, faking your own death.
I'm Elizabeth Greenwood. I'm the author of Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud.
Okay, and tell us a little bit about the book.
So, Playing Dead is a nonfiction book about what it would take to fake your death in the 21st century. I found myself mired in... Sorry. Bonnie, come here.
Bonnie is Greenwood's dog.
We'll take that one again. Bonnie, come here. You're being a diva on set. I found myself in a lot of student loan debt, like so many of my generation, to the tune of six figures, and wasn't really thrilled about that. Wasn't really thrilled about my life decisions that brought me there. So I just had the kind of fantasy of, man, what if I could find a rickety country at the beach and no extradition policy and just slip through the cracks? And a friend of mine very jokingly said, oh, or you could fake your death. And just that idea really got me sent to the races about what is that about? Can people still do that in the 21st century with all this technology? Can that help you or hinder you? And, you know, I wanted to approach this question from a really broad purview, you know, because we have heard so many great pop culture lore about Elvis faking his death, for example. So I was just really interested in approaching this topic very broadly, very holistically, to see what this thing is all about.
Is it possible to fake your death or to disappear and have nobody find you in 2020 or even, say, 20 years ago in 2000, 2001?
Well, anything's possible. The problem is proving a negative is really hard to do, right? So if we think that people successfully fake their death or disappeared, we don't really have proof of that. Of course, if it's a fake death, you don't have a body you can prove to say, I did this. I think the real burden of proof kind of falls on people not being found, right? On people not having, you know, anything turn up to suggest that they did in fact fake something. So it's a kind of tricky thing to quote-unquote prove.
Can you talk about the top motivations people have for faking their own deaths and then kind of the breakdown between men and women?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the type of fake death we hear about the most is for life insurance fraud. So this is a kind of fake death for profit. It's almost too tempting, right? You see that you can take out this policy and pay a fraction of what your eventual payout would be in your death, and people think, well, I don't want to wait. I want to be around for that money. So That's a really common one. Of course, there's a lot of life insurance fraud cases where they'll try to file the claim still without a body, and those take 7 years to pay out. Or people in certain cases will try to pass off bodies that are not theirs as their own, which is a whole other thing. And from my experience and from interviewing various private investigators who look at this sort of thing, it does seem to skew very male, this particular type of death fraud.
But in general, faking your own death is very much a male thing, right?
Right. So again, this gets us into this fishy burden of proof. So the people who fake their deaths and get caught are men, right? So people who fake their deaths and don't get caught, we don't know about. We presume they're dead. So it's very possible that these are more women who do that. But the ones that we can prove who get caught do tend to be men.
It's... I'm trying to let you speak and not laugh too much as you're speaking, but why do you think women would be better at faking their own deaths?
Well, I think that women, if we're going to go with the premise that women don't fake their deaths as much, which I think is true, and they don't fake their deaths because women just, you know, are culturally conditioned to be caretakers, to be the people who stick around. We have a term, deadbeat dad. We don't have a term called deadbeat mom, even though, of course, that happens in certain cases. Women are just feel, I think, a greater burden of responsibility for their families, for their lives, for their dependents. So for a woman to fake her death, the motive, I think, would have to be much more serious than trying to cash out on an insurance fraud policy, trying to light out with your second family, which is another reason men fake their deaths. So I think when women do fake their deaths, they are doing it for much more serious reasons, usually for threat of violence, usually because they're really trying to save their own lives. Therefore, the stakes are just a lot higher. And you know, I think that at least in a lot of the men that I spoke with who faked their deaths, there was this kind of like, oh, wow factor that they wanted to share with people. So they would do it, get away with it, and then like blab to people that they did it because they were so proud of themselves. I don't think women have that same ego thrust. Of course, I'm speaking in very broad generalizations right now. But when I look at the breakdown, when I look at the different cases, that does seem to be a truism.
So, in terms of motives, am I pronouncing his last name Frank Ahern?
Ahern.
Ahern, mm-hmm. Okay. Frank said typically his client, Frank, by the way, helps people disappear. Mm-hmm. Typically, client motives, number one, money, number two, violence, and the bronze medal, occasionally love.
Yeah.
And he said between 2001 to 12, he helped about 50 people disappear and charged about $30,000 per case, but that if a woman came to him in imminent danger, that he would not charge them?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what are some of the steps that you would take to fake your own death? And is it something that you think you could do on a spur of the moment if you hadn't been planning it before and get away with it?
So to the latter part of your question, absolutely not. I think to successfully fake your death, and again, this is coming from taking from the experiences of people who did fake their deaths successfully for, you know, a matter of years in some cases. It's really hard to speak to these ones that we just don't know that are presumed dead, of course. These are people who put in lots and lots of very thoughtful planning about what they were going to do later on, how they were going to support themselves, how they were really going to stay off the grid or at least cut off from their previous life. So to the former part of your question about how you would fake your death, this is a question I asked a lot to everyone from people who did it themselves to investigators to law enforcement, and they always came back with the same question to me, which is, well, who's looking for you? If you are a hedge fund person like Sam Israel III, who staged his death in 2008 after absconding with $500 million of investor money, there's quite a few people looking for you, right? You know, from the FBI to private investigators, the SEC, like you name it. if you're just a regular Joe who isn't evading law enforcement or legal consequences or debt collectors like of the FBI or, you know, I don't know, mafia level or something, people who really care about their money, right? I think that it's a bit easier. So it's really a question about who cares about you. That also kind of circles back to family. I mean, if you are someone who doesn't have a lot of family or is estranged from your family, where the family who's left behind and grieving and confused isn't going to hire a private investigator to look for you, you know, that's also a bit easier. So I think that's really the big question in, when it comes to how you do it and the level of subterfuge you need to employ is who's looking for you.
So some of these cases, I'm going to list them off, and then I was wondering if you could talk about them. Sure. So Sam Israel III, Benny Wendt, John Darwin, and then Lisa Boosin.
Yes.
Can you just kind of run us through and tell us some about these individual cases?
Sure. So Sam Israel III was the founder of the Bayou Hedge Fund Group. And in 2008, it came to light that it had been a rather large Ponzi scheme. At that time, it was the largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history until Bernie Madoff's came to light just a few months later. There's a great book about Sam Israel III called Octopus by Guy Lawson, which I highly recommend because Sam faking his death is like the least crazy thing in Sam's story. So anywho, he had stolen essentially this money and it all came out. He faked his death by staging what was to appear a suicidal plunge off the Bear Mountain Bridge in upstate New York, about 30 miles north of the city. He'd parked his car on the bridge, and in the windshield, in the dust on the windshield, wrote, "Suicide is painless." Also happens to be the theme song from MASH. So he jumped off the bridge. He landed in construction nets that had been strung below. And, you know, kind of MacGyver style, like hand over hand, crawled out to the other side, to the New York State side, where he was picked up by an accomplice and then lit out in an RV. And no one found him for almost a month. He was staying at campgrounds around New York and New England. He saw himself on America's Most Wanted at one point, and he turned himself in. So even with this many people looking for him and people were pressing his family and telling them they were going to go to jail and all this, you know, he turned himself in. So make what you will of that.
Was there suspicion from the start?
Absolutely, yeah. I think Frank said it best. You know, the FBI didn't show up and say, "Oh, he left a suicide note. Let's go home, guys." Like, you know, this was suspicious from the beginning, again, because of the circumstances of his life at the time.
So the next one, Benny Wendt, disappeared in 1989.
I remember about this one.
He left behind a grieving fiance and a 4-year-old daughter from a previous marriage. I guess, you know, I'd ask you in relation to that, the people that whose cases you examined or the people that you interviewed, what kind of role did family play? How close they were to their family? How many people were looking for them? Were, you know, certain people were willing to do this even if they were very close to or loved members of their family?
Yeah, the family piece is really interesting because in a lot of cases, some people's family members, whether it was a spouse or a son or daughter, were in on it with them, especially in the life insurance fraud cases, because you need someone to claim the policy, the payout, right? So they'd have to be conspiring with you. In certain cases, people had no idea and, you know, did go to a great deal of trouble and expense in hiring investigators to check into all these things. But family, interestingly enough, is one of the main ways in which people give themselves up, because I think we have this idea that when we fake our own deaths, we're leaving behind who we were and becoming someone else. So there's an example in the book to like kind of scale it out for people who don't think about faking their deaths all the time. I mean, I guess there are people out there like that. You know, it's the same idea if you think about if you were to move to California, say, and you would be this totally different, improved, better, optimized version of yourself in California. Well, you get to California and shit, you're still you. That's the gag. That's kind of the bad news, right? So when people fake their deaths, similarly, they think that they're going to be able to kind of leave behind all the parts of themselves that were crappy, that had committed crimes, that had made all these terrible mistakes, and still maintain some part of them that is precious and is special to them. But when you fake your death, it really means cutting off everyone and everything. It's a complete severing. So the ways in which a lot of people have gotten caught over the years is because they can't make that clean cut. They still want to call mom on her birthday. You still want to check in on your daughter and see how things are going. And unfortunately, you just can't. So we've seen a lot of people get caught in that very way.
Those are the people whose families actually believe that their loved ones died. But can you talk a little bit about some of the people whose families were in on it? So John Darwin is probably the most interesting part or case in the book. Can you talk about him?
Yeah, absolutely. So John Darwin is an Englishman, and in 2002, he staged his death at sea. He's kind of that phrase, which I never understand, the exception that proves the rule. He staged his death at sea and did it quite successfully for, I believe, almost 2007? He's gone, 5 to 6 years. Anyway, John Darwin, English guy, he had worked jobs such as being a teacher, a prison guard, kind of mid-level civil servant jobs. And at the time, he'd gotten himself into a bit of real estate and credit card debt. So he had the brilliant idea to stage this kayaking accident at sea, collect life insurance along with...
Oh, wow, an interview.
Yeah. What's it called when you... Oh, my God, I'm just having such a brain fart right now. When you retire, like you're... It's like a civil
We're not
going to
retire.
I know, ever.
Your
what's
pension?
It? Pension. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. It would have taken me a long time to get there. Thanks a lot. And collect pensions that his wife would collect after he... was deceased. So one day in March of 2002, Darwin packs his kayak with some dry clothes, some food, paddles out, has a few witnesses that see him do it, who are walking their dogs on the beach, capsizes his canoe. They call it canoe in England. It's really a kayak here, of course. Swims to shore. His wife, a few hours later, picks him up. She's in on this, of course, and drives him to the train station. He takes a train to the west coast of England, where he then goes and camps out on the beach for a few months, gets completely gaunt, like grows a weird beard, all this. A few months later, his wife picks him up and brings him back home where he lives next door to his own house. So in the intervening time, she was completely playing the part of the grieving widow. They had two adult sons who thought that their dad was dead. She let them believe that. And she'd started the process of starting to collect some of these payouts. So the crazy thing about Darwin is that he did live next door to his own house. You know, his sons would visit here and there, and, you know, he'd make himself scarce at those times, of course.
Just to emphasize how crazy this is, in 2002, John Darwin faked his own death. His wife was in on it. He moved home. And the entire time, his sons thought he was dead.
Darwin didn't get caught. He did turn himself in. Eventually, he says it was because he couldn't take lying to his sons anymore.
Enjoy all your favorite sports like never before at BetMGM. Signing up and playing is so easy. Simply sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. When you register with BetMGM, you can get instant access to a variety of parlay selection features, live betting options, and the best daily promotions in the business. And with BetMGM at your fingertips, every play and every game matter more than ever. Place your moneyline, prop, and parlay bets with the king of sportsbooks today. Sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. That's right, up to $1,500. Again, sign up using code Buckeye and receive up to $1,500 back in bonus bets if you don't win your first bet. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards are non-withdrawable bonus bets that expire in 7 days. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park. That's 1-800-GAMBLER.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Hey guys, you know what this playground could use? A wine country, huh?
A redwood forest would be cool.
Ski slopes!
Wait! Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you, from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about this case. Sneha Philip, had you heard of her before I contacted you?
I had not heard of her, and I was so excited when I saw this case because I think it's completely fascinating. But no, I had not heard of her.
Sneha was 31 years old on 9/11. Yep. She was a medical resident, described by many people as brilliant, really smart, extroverted, but also troubled, maybe dealt with mental illness, substance abuse, affairs. Somebody that, who knew her told me that she really didn't want to be a doctor, that she came from a conservative, traditional Indian family that kind of pushed her into medicine, but that her love was art and poetry. It seems crazy. Like, it's fascinating, and because there is no physical evidence that she died at the Trade Center, there's been no DNA match, none of her belongings have been positively identified, and when you combine that with the fact of who she was as this kind of brilliant, confident person, you know, really, really smart by all accounts, and the fact that nobody knows where she stayed on the night of September 10th, if there was someone who could or would try to successfully pull this off, it seems to be her. So I thought it was fascinating. I was reading this book, and I didn't know if you were aware of this case, obviously, when I read the book, but you say,
missing persons reports in the immediate wake of the attacks climbed over 6,000, but the official lives lost totaled 2,801 at the first year of commemoration. Of those more than 3,000 misidentified deaths, 44 were claims for people who were either still alive or people who did not exist.
So those 44 are numbers that come from what the NYPD called Operation Vulture Sweep. And that was for people who were just like very flagrant fraudsters, like inventing a spouse who they say worked at Cantor Fitzgerald. And they were really just trying to very boldly exploit charities and collect money. And these were like very easily disproven.
And then the next passage, this is what really got me. And I highlighted it, I put a bracket, and then I put a giant highlighted star on the page.
Imagine coming up from the subway, recognizing the tragedy, immediately computing it as an opportunity, an opening, and slinking away. Nothing filed, no attempt at life insurance, just a split second's decision to vanish.
Why 9/11? Why did you put that in the book before you were even aware of this case? Why does it fascinate you?
You know, I think it in our whole collective memory, it's just such a seared moment for all of us, right? It was just like this utter chaos and you couldn't wrap your mind around it, right? So I think the idea that someone could make something, I don't want to necessarily say positive, but that someone could see this utter tragedy and destruction and see have a kind of light bulb moment, I think maybe it's just that contrast that is really what kind of gets into my imagination, at least.
Something that Frank said, he used the phrase austere elegance, which stuck out to me. Having looked at this case, what's your general impression?
Man, it's so interesting. It's just so fascinating. I mean, there's so many really compelling loose ends. She herself is such an interesting person, I think. I think that's what really gets me about this case is that, you know, she seemed to be embroiled in quite a bit of paradoxes. You know, I don't obviously know her. I don't know the situation, but, you know, it sounded like she was in a marriage, but maybe had other identities that she was trying to express at the same time. So I just think about her, and I think, you know, now you said this thing about being a doctor, but really wanting to be an artist, you know, just these forces at her that were at odds. And, you know, sounds by all accounts like a really brilliant and interesting person. When you think about your kind of fake death hero, which I never found in the course of my research in terms of someone who fakes their death for what seems like an altruistic or legitimate purpose, someone who's not just kind of like a, you know, bottom feeder trying to scam money out of these things, you know, she seems like she could be that person. She had maybe some interesting motivations. Also, it sounds like had some trouble with perhaps substance abuse and, as you suggested, mental illness, which, again, when you think about the mindset of kind of desperation of trying to make this calculus add up, that this is the best course of action, perhaps some of those impulses could have led her there. So I think she's so interesting. And then, of course, you know, you just have that last image of her, you know, the last images of her at Century 21 buying lingerie. Of course, that's like very Lifetime movie and super, you know, scintillating, I guess. But also, I think it's that her husband said that there was perhaps someone who looked like her that was seen standing in front of the elevators of her building and then turning around. I mean, it's all just so elliptical and mysterious and just completely fascinating.
Well, the question too is like, she either was alive on the night of September 10th, right, or she wasn't. Uh-huh. And most likely, obviously, she was alive, so she stayed somewhere. Mm-hmm. So where did she stay the night of September 10th? I mean, it's, if it was anybody, if it was a family member or a friend, I mean, obviously they would have come forward. So then what are the alternatives? Is that she stayed with someone with whom she was having an affair, maybe, and they didn't want to come forward? But you start to run through your mind. Am I missing anything? Can you think of any logical alternatives of where she might have been the night of the 10th?
Oh, me, no, definitely not. I mean, I think, unfortunately, when we look at these cases of women in particular disappearing, you know, unfortunately, it's usually because they've been abducted and oftentimes murdered. Unfortunately, you know, it, from what I've seen, these cases, it's not what we want them to be. It's not this projection of sovereignty and freedom and reclamation. It's often, almost always, violence at the hands of someone else.
Had you ever seen this postcard?
No.
So,
oh, that's eerie.
Right? This is a postcard sent to Post Secret. It says, "Everyone who knew me before 9/11 believes I'm dead," over a picture of the burning Twin Towers. So you've never seen that before?
No.
So the idea that anybody out there, that there's somebody out there who use 9/11 as a cover to disappear. Because you wouldn't even say necessarily fake their own death because they didn't cause 9/11. Mm-hmm. I mean, they just... Do you think that that's feasible at all?
Gosh, I mean, I've thought about this a lot over the years, and I have loved to kind of think about this dark fantasy of someone who's on their way to work on the morning of 9/11, gets out of the subway, sees what's going on, and somehow in that instant, in that split second, is able to do this calculus and take advantage of that situation for the means of disappearing. I think that's more in the realm still of fantasy and art. I mean, it just seems so impossible to not only lay the groundwork. Of course, during September 11th, there was such a great deal of chaos that in that initial aftermath, the first few months after, you know, when things are in disarray, it seems like you probably could have, you know, been able to get away with it for a short period of time. I don't think in the long run, though. I think there's so many steps that one needs to take to go about making a believable identity that's going to really hold water over the course of years.
Well, when you talk about a believable identity, though, I mean, there are 11 million undocumented workers mm-hmm. in this country who don't all have... Mm-hmm. quote, you know, by the legal sense, believable identities. I mean, would you really Absolutely. Need to have all that lined up? I mean, would stop you from going to maybe, you know, Los Angeles or another city and kind of blending in? I mean, with even without an ID.
Sure. So if you take the example of undocumented workers, you're absolutely right. But, you know, when we're talking about undocumented workers, the type of work these people are doing is usually off the books. It's usually kind of labor that is extremely difficult, often very dangerous. The people who are educated just wouldn't do or won't do for a long period of time. So I think when you think about having a quote-unquote believable identity, you either go very kind of analog, like in this way, where everything's off the books, you're staying completely offline, everything's in cash. Or conversely, you've invested quite a bit of money and time and resources into getting pristine documents, into building a credit history of another person. So you look like a believable person who didn't just, he was born yesterday and had this, you know, you're 37 with a line of credit, right?
And the third option, I guess, would be having somebody in on it who had money or who was willing to support you, right?
Yeah, but what do you do, though, over the long haul, right? Like, that's the question. I mean, I think you can do that for a few years, maybe. But when you think about decades, right, and if you are a person from a professional background and you do have very specific profile, a portfolio of interests, it's really hard to just erase all of that and become someone so counter to who you were.
The thing is, though, the idea that Sneha used 9/11 to disappear 20 years ago and the idea that she's still alive are two different things. Studies show that missing women are at a much higher risk of dying by murder or suicide. It's depressing, I know. But even if Sneha did survive, if she did abscond, there's no guarantee that she's still alive. She could be a Jane Doe somewhere. But
if she did successfully disappear, don't we just kind of want to let her disappear in peace?
That's a good question. I think if, personally, yeah. I would, if I found her somehow, I would leave it up to her whether or not she wanted to come forward. Like, it's a really good question. There's a good ethical, well, first of all, I mean, by that point, you know, we've made it pretty far in the investigation.
Totally.
No, that's a great ethical question. I haven't thought too much.
I don't know the answer myself. I just think if she's able to get away with it for this long.
What I would do is, personally, if I were to magically find her, I would approach her. I'd talk to her. I wouldn't, you know, all of a sudden blast out that I had found her or where she was. It's not my place to judge. Mm-hmm. And I think I probably would treat her like a source. I'd probably say I have all these questions. You absolutely fascinate me. You fascinate the world. This is incredible.
Totally.
But I'm happy to respect your anonymity and your privacy in terms of where you are,
totally,
what your identity is. But it's tough as a journalist, and I also just look at there are other people doing it and doing it.
Yeah, with really crappy.
Like, really, like, some of the, like, totally, some of the headlines from when she disappeared, like, under, you know, the post,
of course, it was like,
it's like the most, like, salacious thing.
Totally.
And somehow it was initially reported, or even in the court case, it was like, she's conducting bisexual acts.
Oh my gosh.
And it's,
yeah,
like, what, you know, is this, like, you imagine the, like, Puritan,
right,
like, oh, we are in a court of law. Like,
ridiculous.
But no, I mean, that's a good question. But I guess, you know, it's a fair ethical point. I would ask you, separate from the show, wouldn't she be the, like, I don't want to say the most magical example.
The Holy Grail, absolutely. I mean, people ask me all the time, like, oh, so did you ever talk to someone who faked their death and they were still presumed dead? And no, I never have. Like, never got that phone call. I would love to, and I'm available if anyone wants to talk. But no, she would be everything to speak to that experience if, presuming she did disappear and has managed to stay gone for almost 20 years now, I would live to talk to her, just to have a coffee with her and ask her what that's been like and everything, and try to leave it at that. Let her go back to her wherever she is.
Well, I guess I would ask you the same question because, you know, I'm working on this project specifically, but you worked on the broader perspective here. How would you handle that ethically? Let's say you were researching this story and you found her sitting at a cafe or an apartment in Los Angeles or something. How would you handle it? Oof. If she said, I don't want you to report that I'm still alive, would you respect that? Or would you find a balance between...
Oh, God. That's a doozy. That's a real doozy. I think what I would do is I would try to stay on her as gingerly as possible. That's always kind of my MO, and probably yours too. When you go into this kind of work, you don't easily take no for an answer. So I think I would try to stay on her, build some trust, hopefully. I think I would try to meet or talk on the phone under the cover of total anonymity, total privacy. And I don't know, maybe it's cowardly, but maybe there's some way you can split the difference where you can say you did speak with her, but not reveal any of the details.
That's what I would see. You see, know? I agree with you. Like,
yeah,
it's really hard, especially this.
But then
is...
her family's out there, you know? And if they would have, but who knows? I mean, maybe families usually know more than they let on. So.
Yeah, you have all these ethical and then maybe even legal implications.
Yes.
So, like, I don't know. It's interesting. You'd also have to be really careful about how you approach her. It couldn't just be like, I'm going to place a phone call. And,
yeah.
And then the minute that somebody gets a hold of my phone records, well, the book is Playing Dead. We're not live, but I'm going to give you the NPR treat. My guest today on this cold COVID death winter, about to snow day as we're shivering, is Elizabeth Greenwood. Did I miss anything? Is there anything else you want to say? Any important points?
I don't think so. Those are really good questions.
So, in the end, can we rule out the idea that Sneha used 9/11 as cover to voluntarily disappear? No, I don't think so. She was a brilliant woman, unhappy with life, her marriage, and her profession. The idea that she ran away, well, the only remarkable thing about it is 9/11. Otherwise, it's not unique. Thousands of people disappear every year. The postcard says, everyone who knew me before 9/11 believes I'm dead. Change 9/11 to any other day. Is it really that crazy? Next week, we're going to release a special bonus episode. We'll be back with a brand new full episode the week after that. Homework. 1. Did you successfully fake your own death and get away with it? Do you know anyone else who did? 2. Did you send a 9/11 postcard to Post Secret? If so, whether it's real or a hoax, I'd love to hear from you. I'll protect your identity. You can reach us by phone at 1-833-NEW-TIPS. That's 1-833-639-8477. Again, 1-833-639-8477. Or you can reach us via email at tips@iheartmedia.com. That's tips, T-I-P-S, at iheartmedia.com. Ben Bolin is our executive producer. Paul Deccan is our supervising producer. Chris Brown is our assistant producer. Seth Nicholas Johnson is our producer. Sam Teagarden is our research assistant. And I'm your host and executive producer, John Walczak. Cover art by Pam Peacock. Please donate to the Internet Archive. It's a vital resource. Go to archive.org/donate. Missing Person Study participants voiced by Samantha McVeigh, Annie Reese, Brandy Supra, Paul Deccan, and Alice Chelsurawong. Special thanks to Tamika Campbell at iHeart and to Christoph Zappari in New Orleans. Also, thank you to Dr. E, Mark Bogatin, Detective Richard Stark, Elizabeth Greenwood, and Aesop Rock. Go buy Elizabeth's book, Playing Dead, A Journey Through the World of Death Fraud. She's a great writer, and it's a fun book. Elizabeth also has a brand new book coming out this month called Love Lockdown, Dating, Sex, and Marriage in America's Prisons. Original theme music by Aesop Rock. Check out Aesop's website at aesoprock.com. You can find me on Twitter at John Walczak, JonWalczak. If you like this show, check out our first season, Missing in Alaska, about the 1972 disappearance of two congressmen. Missing on 9/11 is a co-production of iHeartRadio and Greenfort Media.
Hey guys, back at the playground again, huh?
Yep. You know what this playground could use? A wine country.
Heck yeah. And some waves. So we could go surfing.
Oh, yeah. Ah, love that.
A redwood forest would be cool.
I'm in.
Ah, ski slopes.
Let's do it.
Can a girl go shopping?
Yeah, baby.
Wait. Did we just invent California?
Discover why California is the ultimate playground at visitcalifornia.com.
With every CBD product claiming to do something different, it's nearly impossible to decide what's best for you. Lazarus Naturals pioneered the farm-to-front-door model of transparency where they handle each step of the production process to ensure quality, potency, and consistency. Scannable labels allow you to see the test results of your hemp batch so you can be confident in the safety and quality. Visit LazarusNaturals.com today. Lazarus Naturals, committed to improving your life as well as the world around you. Not available in Idaho, Iowa, or South Dakota.
Let's clear out winter and clean up the lawn with Spring Black Friday Savings at the Home Depot. Right now, get the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower for just $89 and make your lawn work easier with a powerful 90 miles an hour of clearing power. And with convenient online shopping, you can order on the app, pick up in store, and get outside sooner. Get your yard spring ready with the Ryobi One Plus Leaf Blower, now just $89 during Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.